Everyone here for the first Capital Investment Committee meeting of the 2018 session. There is a quorum present, and so the we'll have the approval of the minutes for May 4th. Representative Dean, would you move the minutes?
Oh, I was all set.
I will, Mr. Chair.
Get them all read over?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Representative Franke, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? First motion without a hitch. All right. Just a couple of, I guess we're starting today with an overview of Governor Dayton's 2018 bonding request by the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, Myron Franz, and the Commissioner of Department of Administration, Matt Mossman. And I think before you get into the present year's request, we do have a little situation from last year that perhaps the commissioners can answer. Sometimes when we fund things, we have the wrong language or need some clarification in some way. And we have a situation right now for the St. Cloud intake project where MMB will not release the funds, $19 million. This is the same language since 2014, the language that had been drafted by MMB. It's in the governor's bill. And yet MMB won't release the money until there is corrected language. And this is a time-sensitive project. And, we would like to know why this money isn't being released and if we have to do something to make sure that it is released. So that little question can be the first thing you guys consider, if you would. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Welcome. Thank you for the welcome, Mr. Chair. My name is Myron Franz, Minnesota Commissioner of Management and Budget, and thank you for that warm welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration, I'll take the first crack at this. The Department of Administration manages the construction projects for the Department of Corrections, and you may be familiar, there's language in the state constitution that reads in part that each law authorizing the issuance of bonds shall distinctly specify the purposes thereof. And so it's my understanding that over a long period of time that this has been expected to articulate the scope of the project, and in particular in this case, distinguishing when there's new construction or new construction only versus restoration or renovation of existing space. And I can't speak specifically to all of the previous projects. I think the previous projects might have been more exclusively new construction. This project is a heavily integrated, this phase is a heavily integrated new construction and renovation of existing space. And so the challenge arises in that the language in statute only, or the language in the bill that legislation that was passed last year refers only to the construction and equipment of a new intake unit and loading dock. That there is going to be some new space, but there's also going to be significantly renovated kitchen space, et cetera, and all of the project work that needs to happen needs to integrate the HVAC systems and integrate all of the major building systems into that one space. So there's no way to sort of start the project as the new construction only and phase it new construction versus existing. It really is an integrated project from the front end.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you raised this issue because we, of course, always assume that the departments are taking a really close look at the language before final passage, so that something can still be corrected, because something like that would have been known, I would think, if someone in the department had the responsibility of, because we know every word has to be right, but that sort of has to be a partnership between the author and the and the departments that are relevant to it, and I don't know if something new has been happening, but I think, Mr. Chair, it's also why we always hope that we see that bill before the final night so that they have time to do some of that, but it's frustrating when they can't get at the money.
Commissioner Franz?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I appreciate your concern. And one of the things I think that has worked really very well over the years is the cooperation of the legislative staff and the agency staffs who write this, and also MMB. And it's unfortunate when these errors occur. And I think the key is, as you suggest, is to make sure that we continue to share language all the way through the process, because these things, you know, they develop over time. And to share throughout the legislative process, share the changes in languages, and make sure that all the staff are looking at it. So we'll do our utmost to make sure that this doesn't happen again. It's unfortunate when it does, but I think one of the things we just have to do is correct the language.
I'll just comment that, you know, there were no changes in language on this. This is the same since 2014. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, my question is of Commissioner Mossman. The bond houses would also weigh in on this if I recall, if you don't have the appropriate description. You referenced the Constitution, but wouldn't there be a question about whether the bond houses would issue the bonds if it wasn't properly described?
Mr. Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do work, obviously, that's sort of the backstop, if you will, is always whenever there's a language dispute, we ship it to the bond counsel, outside bond counsel, to review and give their opinion on. And so that's something that we always have to be careful of, is to make sure that we comply with the constitutional requirements about bonding only for government-owned, state-owned property and no private interest. So those are, and also sort of what is the bill actually authorized the state to do. So those are critical elements for the bond counsel to review.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, he referenced bond counsel. I was referencing the bond houses, but I guess it's one and the same in that case. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, any other further questions on this topic? Otherwise, Representative Constantine.
I'm not sure if this is exactly the right time, but I have a question for maybe nonpartisan staff and administration. I just left HHS Finance. And one of the bonding requests coming in is for $19.9 million for a building that was built for $60 million in 2005. And some of the stuff that was done on that building, it's hard to believe that when the proposal went out, for example, they used galvanized steel for the ductwork instead of stainless steel. You would think that given what they're using the building for, they would have started with stainless steel. Is it possible to find out what the proposal went out at that time? Because my initial reaction is, why didn't they go back to the contractors and say, you screwed up? This is for the building for agriculture and DHS, their laboratories. It's a third of what the original cost is now to go back and retrofit it, and it looks like negligence to me. But if that wasn't in the original proposal, then somebody messed up when they put out the original proposal. So I'd like to see what the original proposal was and why it was so poorly, or if it wasn't. We need to start and find out, first of all, what the original proposal was for the building and if the contractor messed up. But coming back 13 years later on a building and having to retrofit a third of the cost seems to me to be just a terrible. I see Gavin over there twitching. Has he got an idea? Do you, Gavin?
Representative Constantine, would you specify which building?
It's the building for the laboratories for the Department of DHS and Agriculture that they are asking for $19.9 million in the bonding request for a building that was built in 2005 for $60 million. Thank you, Mr. Nash. Representative Nash has got a better... Chime in there, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with the building, if you would like me to respond.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the question that Representative Constantine is asking about is the Ag Health Lab building, the Freeman Building on the Capitol Complex here. As many of you may know, and I'm not the Commissioner of Health, so I'm going to get my levels wrong, but this is not an unsophisticated building. This health lab is a, I believe it's a level 3 rated health lab, meaning it can substitute for the Centers for Disease Control. It's a very high-end lab, and part of the discussion that is going on here is related to upgrading and replacing the HVAC system, which is a very, frankly, it's inefficient, but it was also, it's an area where technology has changed a substantial amount, actually, in that period of time since the building was constructed. So there is a combination of both, I think, questions that we can follow up on that Representative Constantine is asking, but also legitimate changes in technology and need an opportunity here for this building and the desire to maintain it at that level of integrity and service level for the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Before we continue with the commissioners, Representative Lilly, did you have a comment or announcement or something you wanted to make?
Mr. Chair, I thought maybe at the end of the meeting, but I'll happily do it now. I understand we had a birthday, so there's some of our chief of staff there. There's some cupcakes over there.
Where are the cupcakes?
So,
oh, in the cup.
Whose birthday, Gavin?
Very important.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I wanted to get that away early in case people left during the meeting and didn't benefit from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was so distracted by Representative Considine's question, I'm still trying to gather all that.
All right. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll get into the business at hand. Commissioners, begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll get started. I want to give a brief overview of the governor's proposed capital budget bill, and then Commissioner Mossman will speak to some of the fundamental issues surrounding asset preservation and why that's such a predominant theme in the governor's bill. You know, we've all been hearing how often Minnesota is often ranked as number one or number two in best-run state or best state. Today, I think we're the second-best state. But the key to a lot of these rankings by different agencies is the fact that Minnesota is known as the place where things get done, where things work, and we have a talented workforce, we have a diverse economy. But one of the things we really need to do is to maintain that advantage that we have and maintain the assets that we do. And that means by making smart investments in our communities around the state. One of the things that the governor believes, and I know that many of you do as well, and together we've done a lot of bonding projects the last 7 years with Governor Dayton and this committee, but that is to make sure that we support a robust bonding bill. And obviously for us, a robust bonding bill may be different than what you're thinking. But right now, interest rates are still relatively low, and we believe that the necessity to maintain these state assets really is important. The governor's budget makes investments around the state, and as you look at the first slide, or the first piece of paper in the slide deck, you can see that he's proposed a $1.5 billion state investment. 35% of that is for higher education, $541 million for world-class colleges and universities. And I know that President Cater from the U is here, as well as Chancellor Govender from Minnesota State is here to give you more details about that. But in addition, we really have focused a lot of priority on water quality and finding water problems that need to be corrected. We have about 32% of the asset preservation dollars go to state assets. Another 8% go to housing, and another 14% go to local and other infrastructure areas. So as the governor has considered all these requests, he put this out on January the 16th. He proposed $1.45 billion in general obligation bonds. $110 million of that was in appropriation bonds, and $40 million in trunk highway bonds. And I should also emphasize that the governor's recommendations leverage an additional $570 million in federal, local, and private funds that helped create a $2 billion investment in Minnesota's capital infrastructure. If you go to the next page in your handout, you'll see this is the breakdown for the legislative bodies and the legislative committees that will hear the different parts of this bill. We just provide this for your information. Clearly, I'm not going to go into detail in the different agencies and the bonding requests. You'll have a chance to hear each one of those in this committee and in some of the other committees. One of the things, in addition to the about one-third that goes into higher education, is about a third that goes into economic development, water, environmental projects, and another third go to what we consider local projects around the state. But what I really want to talk about next, though, is the debt capacity. So if you go to the next page in your slide, it says managing state debt capacity. And I've heard many questions from some of you and other people about whether we can afford a $1.5 billion bonding bill. Well, tomorrow we'll have a better idea with the forecast, but I want to be clear that the governor's recommendation falls within our debt capacity guidelines. We use these, and the rating agencies use these debt capacity guidelines to evaluate the state in comparison to other states. What the guidelines really mean, the first two guidelines help determine our capacity for additional debt. Both guidelines compare the state's debt to the state's personal income. As of the last forecast in November, the estimated personal income in Minnesota was $303 billion. Now, Guideline 1 measures what the state has sold. Guideline 2 measures a total of what has been authorized but not yet sold. And finally, Guideline 3 helps determine how well we manage and how quickly we pay off that general obligation debt. So in terms of those debt capacity guidelines, Guideline 1 states that the total principal outstanding on our tax-supported bonds shall be 3.25% or less of total state personal income. Well, as of last November, the state's outstanding debt represented 2.59% of personal income, well below the 3.25% cap. Guideline 2 requires that the total principal, both issued and outstanding, of GO bonds, moral obligation bonds, equipment capital leases, and real estate capital leases cannot exceed 6% of state personal income. Last November, the state's total authorized debt represented 3.83% of personal income. Every forecast, we also estimate the maximum amount of borrowing the legislature could authorize without going beyond these debt guidelines. And we will issue a new debt capacity guideline tomorrow along with our economic forecast. This exercise looks at the combined effect of a new authorization of guidelines 1 and 2. In the November forecast, we estimated that the legislature could authorize an additional $3.5 billion in bonding debt before reaching the limit of guideline 1 in fiscal year 2021. We're not recommending that. We're simply saying that is the capacity that we certainly have at this time. Guideline 3 stipulates that 40% of our GO bond debt is scheduled to mature within 5 years, and 70% of the GO bond debt should mature within 10 years, assuming those schedules are consistent with all the useful life of our assets. So not only is Minnesota within all three of these guidelines, MMB is committed to making sure that we get the best rates possible on our bonds. Last September, we sold $858 million in general obligation bonds, and the interest rates range from 1.92%, one of the lowest ever, to 2.74%. This included a refinancing that saved taxpayers $44 million over the life of those bonds. The rating agencies have noticed these good financial management decisions, and they have said many positive things about Minnesota's debt and its GO bond ratings. Standard & Poor's recognize that Minnesota's moderate debt levels and our well-defined debt management guidelines. Moody's acknowledged Minnesota's manageable debt burden. And Fitch also noted our well-established debt policies and cited a low debt burden on the state's financial resources. These rating agencies are experts. They understand the complexities of bonding, and they review our information in detail. After every forecast, we provide updated information to the rating agencies, and we also go and we meet with them before we sell our bonds. I'd like to now move to the debt service costs on the next page. This is just to make clear what we've forecasted for tomorrow. With the budget and economic forecast released tomorrow, we have assumed an $800 million bonding bill this session and a $230 $1 million bonding bill next session. The associated debt service costs included in the forecast for a bill of that size are $13 million for fiscal 18-19 and $102 million in 20 and 21. These anticipated costs, along with our current debt service obligations, total a little over $1.1 billion for 18-19 and a little over $1.2 billion for 2021. After tomorrow's forecast, the governor may make changes to his original capital budget recommendations. Regardless of any changes, the full cost of his bonding bill will be reflected in any supplemental budget that he proposes later in March. I want to go down to the bonding bill during the Dayton administration slide because this is really what we've done together in this committee and this the legislatures that have convened over the last number of years. We've made some real serious and marked capital investments. We're sitting right next door to one of the main ones in the capital, the state capital. But during that time, Governor Dayton signed about $3.6 billion in general fund-backed bonds since he took office. These bonding bills have really changed the landscape of the state, including the state capital, as I mentioned, infrastructure projects all around the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State. Capital investment bills have created new assets like the Vermilion State Park, the Health Science Building at the University of Minnesota, and affordable housing units throughout state of Minnesota. In addition to these projects, there have been countless community projects, including many of those on this committee that you have seen yourself, that have received critical funding for programs like flood hazard mitigation grants, local road and local bridge grants, Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure grants. I'm proud of the work that we've been able to do together in the last over 7 years in Governor Dayton's administration. We look forward to working together on coming up with a bonding bill that meets the needs of the legislature and the state. And anything I can do to help, please don't hesitate to call me. Unless you have any immediate questions, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Mossman.
Thank you, Commissioner Franz. Before Commissioner Mossman begins, does anyone have any particular questions? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, wouldn't it be appropriate to add the existing bonded indebtedness that we have accumulated so far onto the proposed bonded indebtedness we assume we're going to get, giving us the total picture instead of just part of the picture?
Representative Franz.
Thank you.
Didn't want to demote you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, actually, what we try to do, and it's in the forecast package tomorrow, we will put out the total debt obligation. It's a little over $1 billion, as I mentioned. So what we try to do is be really clear in our forecast projections that we are assuming that the debt obligations that we currently have, which is a little over $1 billion, will be presented in the presentation tomorrow.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I agree with many of the things the governor has in there because it's really structured mostly for things that we need to fix, and we have to, like PIPRA and roads and drinking water and other things. I'm not disagreeing with a lot of the items he has. It doesn't seem to be loaded with pork, but it certainly seems to be a rather substantial one considering we had a $1 billion bonding bill last year.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, I appreciate your comments and support of the idea of sort of taking care of what we have, and I think Commissioner Mossman will highlight that a little bit more. It's certainly that is such an important thing. But frankly, we've gotten behind. I mean, I understand the concern about doing a large billion-dollar bonding bill last year, but you remember we didn't do one in 2016, so we've got a little to make up here. But I would suggest, though, that with the rates where they are, with the credit rating that we have, that this is a real opportunity for us to use this time to make a big push that we haven't really made in this area for a long time. And I just think it's the right opportunity now. Thank you for your concern, though.
Commissioner Franz, just to clarify, the billion-dollar debt service, is that for the year or the biennium?
Mr. Chair, that's for the biennium, I believe. Okay, I have to look just to make
sure that everyone understood that. Representative Dean?
No, that was it.
Okay. Commissioner Mossman?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members, again, for the record, Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration, thank you for inviting me here today to discuss Governor Dayton's recommendations for addressing the growing need to preserve state assets and public infrastructure. I want to start with giving a brief overview to Representative Gunther's line of questioning, really, on the scope of the challenge and the need for preservation and maintenance of state assets. The Department of Administration operates the Enterprise Real Property Program, which is a key function of which is to work with state agencies to track the condition of all state-owned properties using objective apples-to-apples criteria. And the Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota have similar systems that we parallel each other to track the condition of our buildings. Those facility condition assessments provide us with essential insight into two types of need. One is whether we are keeping up with the routine maintenance and deferring critical maintenance due to limited resources. And the second is the amounts that will be needed to renew and replace major building systems once they reach the eventual end of their useful life or age out, which is typically about 40 years. What you see summarized in the table on the handout is that there's an estimated $8.2 billion that will be needed over the next 10 years if we are to catch up on deferred maintenance and renew state-owned and higher ed facilities when they reach the end of their useful life. Of that amount, a projected $2.81 billion is needed for assets managed by state agencies on behalf of Minnesotans. If you turn to the next slide, I'm going to focus in my presentation here on Governor Dayton's recommendations for $458 million to restore and maintain buildings and facilities that we already have. Here's what we know. Minnesota state government manages nearly 6,200 buildings on behalf of Minnesotans. So to give you some understanding of those buildings, that's everything from cold storage to office buildings to armories that are in the database, as well as could be outhouses or facilities at the Department of Natural Resources. We, parks and trails, we monitor all of those buildings and their condition and keep track of them separately. Those buildings and facilities are worth an estimated $10 billion, and they're spread across 86 Minnesota counties, with that $10 billion in value spread about evenly across the seven-county metro area in greater Minnesota. Now, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman and others on this committee have provided tremendous leadership over the course of a number of years on the state capitol restoration, and we are thankful for that. The state capitol restoration, as you know, is probably one of the most recognizable of state assets, and that restoration, I think, can be described in many ways, but one applicable way that it can be described for this discussion is certainly as the largest asset preservation project in state history. But I would encourage you to consider that the capital restoration project is actually small and compared to the total capital investment need for infrastructure statewide. If you flip to the next slide, there are over $500 million of asset preservation work that is needed just to fix buildings that we already have today that are in poor or critical condition. The slide here gives you a sense of some broad categories as to how that deferred maintenance need breaks down. Fully 8% of it is in critical life safety systems like stairs, sprinkler systems, standpipes, emergency alert systems, backup generators, and other systems that are already rated poor or unacceptable condition. About 39% is in exterior features such as walls, windows, roofs, leaking roofs, and that sort of thing. To give an example, near Duluth, we have an essential public safety building with its original 1937 windows, brick, and tuck pointing. That's 80 years of Minnesota winter snow and freeze and thaw, and 80 years of wind and rain and hail. And over time, certainly the lack of funding to more timely replace those windows and maintain the exterior has now meant that there's additional damage interior to that building, which raises the cost and makes it a more extensive need. The situation the state faces, frankly, is that we're desperately trying to catch up by fixing broken items and damaged buildings rather than keeping up to prevent damage from occurring in the first place. Efficiency, if we flip to the next slide, is a major consideration here. As you can see, it's a simple reality that the longer you delay, the worse the problem gets and the more it costs. It costs about four times more to transition a building from a poor to a good condition, or about 12 times more to transition from a crisis condition to an excellent than it would to just fund or perform the regular preventative maintenance on those buildings in the first place. A few efficiency examples. Our Wyndham DNR office, there's delays due to inadequate funding have increased the cost of repairs there by an estimated 30% because of leaking roof, siding, and windows has now led to mold, rot, and structural damage interior. Many of you will recall that in this building in 2016, the state paid $1.6 million to make repairs that resulted from one water pipe failure that impacted five floors of the building. It's just simply sound fiscal management to fund preventative maintenance before buildings decline to poor and crisis condition. If we go to the next slide, I'd just like to emphasize we started to put together here where the projects that are being funded by asset preservation requested by state agencies would be located. Again, the state has properties in 86 of 87 counties, and about half and half of that value is split across the metro and greater Minnesota area. So we know that while asset preservation is not always, those funding requests do not always drum up the kind of excitement that new construction does. These meat and potato projects are essential to the safe and well-functioning public infrastructure. And let's make no mistake about it, they are local projects. These buildings are located across the state from the headwaters of the Mississippi, as you can see, to Laverne, and from Thief River Falls to Albert Lea. But also point out that they're not simply office buildings or, as some might like to imagine, cube farms where state employees go to work. These are libraries and laboratories. They're parks and public health facilities. They're historic sites and hiking trails. They're campsites and correctional facilities. So from armories to the Minnesota Zoo, these are all buildings that impact Minnesota's quality of life. Let me paint you a picture as we and leave you with a few more examples as we look at the last slide. In 2017, we had dilapidated ductwork that unexpectedly gave way at a state property in Faribault, falling from the ceiling into a work area. And thankfully, no one was injured in that incident. In Shakopee, we have a facility where the fire alarm system is so far beyond its useful life that the manufacturer refuses to work on it. Instead, the state needs to scour the country to find and pay a premium price for replacement parts and a vendor willing to make those repairs. And then with the photo that you can see, and we have additional photos that at your discretion, Mr. Chair, we would like to hand out to the committee and leave you with some visual stories. But the visual story there that's in your handout is from Fort Snelling, where staff and the State Archaeology Office have worked with this yellow tarp over their head for 2 years. Now, it's a very colorful and attractive tarp in and of itself, but let's make no mistake about it, the tarp is not for decoration. It's to divert water that is constantly leaking into the building, into that tube that you see coming out of the center of the tarp and redirecting it to the drain. So a very ingenious solution, but not the condition that we expect to maintain our state buildings in. These examples, Mr. Chair and members, are not an exhaustive list. I would just close with there's a facility at Old Mill State Park where there's been a suspension bridge that has been closed due to deterioration condition impacting the ability of Minnesotans to enjoy that facility. At Blue Mound State Park, some of you may have heard before that due to groundwater contamination, there's no drinking water, no showers, and no flush toilets for visitors to that site. Funding clearly is needed to connect that park to the rural water system so that it can revive this location as a tourist destination for that local economy. So funding for this kind of infrastructure is not part of agency budgets. It's only funded if we fund it through the appropriations here in the capital investment bill, and I strongly encourage you to fund Governor Dayton's $1.5 billion, including this $458 million, to get this bonding, to get these projects done. That's why the bonding bill exists, I believe. In the end of the day, not every asset preservation project can be as popular as the state capitol, but they all still serve the public, and they're greatly needed and are located across the state. And again, like Mr. Franz, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. When you talk about maintenance, we generally don't fund maintenance here through this committee. I mean, we really fund repairs. And my understanding is maintenance that comes out of your operating budget. So the question is, if we have buildings that are falling behind, I'm not talking about current state, but falling behind, was that bad foresight on us, on not creating a large enough operating budget to maintain buildings to the point that they actually now begin to qualify for bonding for significant repair or renovations?
Commissioner Mossman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, thank you for the question, because I think that that is an important distinction and can get a little bit confusing. Maintenance, the type of maintenance that's funded in operating budgets, and it is relevant to keeping the building up, is things like paint, fixing hinges, waxing the floor, maintaining the building itself, paying for utilities, regular operating costs of a building. It's not funding to replace the roof once every 20 years or to replace windows when it's needed, and that type of asset preservation work to maintain and extend the life of the building.
Representative Dean?
So just to clarify, you're using the term maintenance as typical project and asset repairs that take place on a regular cycle.
Correct.
Burzak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to actually continue that one more question just for clarity. So a broken window or a broken
door
that becomes in.
Would you speak into the microphone, please?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. For the issue of maintenance, and I know that this is quibbling over just a very small thing, but I think it does kind of gross up into these expenses. It's like the maintenance would include the failure of maybe a functioning part of it that you can do within your budget. And I don't want to focus on the could. I mean, probably should or have to reallocate in order to include it in your operating, as opposed to, and I agree that repair could then be understood to include the replacement of a roof system or of the total window system in a building.
Mr. Chair and Representative, and I think if I take you back to what I believe is slide 8 in your packet, we have a high-level breakdown there of two kind of buckets, if you will, of asset preservation and taking care of what we already have. The $850 million there is an estimate of deferred maintenance, and deferred maintenance is the kind of work that might happen once every 2 years, or it might happen on a regular basis, but you're maintaining the HVAC system, you're replacing the roof periodically. There are things that are not, it's work that needs to be, it's tuck pointing, it's work that needs to be done year in and year out or every couple of years to maintain the building in good condition. The second bucket, if you will, is even if you do all of that work after 40 or 50 years, mechanical systems and other major building systems reach the end of their useful life and need to be renewed. And so there really is both of those kinds of work that we're behind on. It is certainly the first bucket that has the greatest impact, I think, on worsening conditions, where if you don't fix the roof and it's leaking, all of a sudden you have mold and foundation damage and interior damage. Certainly, along with the second bucket, you can have inefficiencies that come along by using outdated HVAC systems when you could be saving energy and that sort of thing.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had another question that goes back to the one that said forecasted need, that spreadsheet format. You mentioned the rating system, and I've heard that expressed by the people that manage the universities and that sort of thing, as if it essentially is a common set of ratings that would kind of be with the. What I'm going to get at is ability for you to communicate and me to understand that rating system across state systems, so that when you have a building that is being rated, how is that rating in relationship to me hearing the same thing at the university or me hearing the same thing, maybe even with state assets that are not necessarily like university, college, or physical buildings here on the mall.
Commissioner Mossman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll do the best I can on this, and I know I have staff in the audience that's going to make sure I keep on track. But so essentially there's a rating scale of 1 to 5, and this there's a lot of industry work that goes into this. So it's an industry best practice, and there's a guidebook that's about yay thick that we, the Department of Administration Enterprise Real Property Program, trains people on, works with other state agency partners, that gives guidance to go out and evaluate building by building, building system, all aspects of the building, and view those various condition descriptions for a rating from 1 to 5. And both the condition itself, if you will, and also the age of the system are the major factors, if you will, at assessing what score should be given, objective score should be given. So that guidebook and those instructions, in effect, are developed under state law. It's an industry best practice. We work with an outside vendor to do that and keep those up to speed, and then all the agencies use those. And I know that by statute, I'm not entirely familiar with all of the details of the system that's used in higher education, but the state law does require them to be comparable systems, and I believe that they are.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more. Then on the bottom of that page, you got this 8.2 million, billion?
Billion.
Billion. Lost track of where the zeros were. Is that number, and I'll use the word that comes from my financial background, is that number grossed up over 10 years, or is that number appreciated over 10 years, or is that just the number today that we all know is going to inflate and or gross up over time by the time we get to 10 years?
Commissioner Mott.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe in effect that would be a net present value, $8.2 billion. We believe that we'll need $8.2 billion over a 10-year period.
Just another question regarding, deferred maintenance. One of the reasons why the state capitol wound up in the condition that it was in is because I think we fell down on the maintenance over the years. Have you made provisions for the future for the capitol?
Mr. Chair, I'm delighted to say we'll probably have an opportunity to visit on that more in the next week's Capital Preservation Commission meeting, but we have not, as you know, we built into in lieu of rent, and we had that conversation with the legislature this past biennial budget session to be able to do more of the construction contractor recommended investigations and routine inspection and that sort of thing to know how the building was being, what the condition was over time and what the systems looked like. We don't have a fund built in to actually fund that work when it might arise 10 years from now. That would at this point still be coming back to the bonding bill for those funds.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've sometimes wondered if we wouldn't serve everyone better if we got out of this situation of talking about a bonding year and a non-bonding year, and where we do something big and then we maybe don't do anything. And so I've sometimes wondered if higher ed and agencies don't have to ask for a really large asset preservation number because they never know when they'll get the next one. And if we were more dependable, it would almost seem as though we'd do better to have just an absolutely equal year-to-year investment, because in most of these cases, they're hiring people to do the work, and so it's a steady flow of work. How do we break bad habits? I've sort of argued with you, like, then when you do your forecast, you keep us in that mentality. When you say, 1 year you project 800 and the next one 200 or 750, whatever, And that keeps us stuck in that same way of doing things. But that means every year we're falling further behind with infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, I'm always happy to admit that I can do better. And one thing I'd like to do better at is a constant higher level of bonding bills. And one of the reasons we do the forecasting the way that we do, that's been part of custom and practice with the legislature and MMB over 10 years. We're happy to change that custom if we can reach an agreement with the legislature, because I think you're right, it does force us into this big bonding bill in the even numbered years and a small bonding bill in the odd numbered years. And clearly what we're seeing now is the need to have a major bonding bill in every year. And I think, you know, if you look over the history of bonding bills, it tends to follow the big bill one year and a small bill the next, but there have been a lot of exceptions to that. I think one of the ways we get away from doing that is the forecast assumption that you mentioned, and that's something we could easily all get together and agree on and change going forward. But you're right, we have the capacity and the need, I think, to do a major bonding bill every year.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, and I would just add to that on the project management standpoint, your question has a lot of relevance to just to how the efficiency with which and sensibility with which we can go about it. When agencies and the Department of Administration are uncertain about what the level of resources are going to be, it makes a significant impact on our ability to – we're in a position where we're not planning, unfortunately, or able to plan for deferred maintenance and complete things on a we're on a reaction basis rather than completing things on a planned basis. So and that includes both our ability to package things and maybe contract for a whole group of roof repairs or replacements at the same time and get efficiencies that way to how we prioritize those projects.
Thank you. I think we need to move along, but we'll do Representative Detmer first and then move to our colleges and universities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at the military affairs, and we're looking at some readiness centers that we have around the state. I've visited a few of those, obviously, and we're looking at some St. Cloud, Wadena, Brainerd, Grand Rapids, Rosemont Readiness Center, and Fergus Falls Readiness Center. And many of these centers can be dated back many years. And what's the governor's plan to really take a look at these readiness centers that our men and women are serving in our National Guard to make sure that they are brought up to speed?
Well, you know, I'll start. You know, obviously the governor is recommending investment in asset preservation for the Department of Military Affairs, and we work with them to rate their buildings as well. They certainly are regularly assessing and prioritizing the work that needs to be done on those armories and readiness centers. And so there is a substantial investment in the bill for that, and that would be just one of many priorities, obviously, that where asset preservation is needed. So good question.
Mr. Chair, I know the Military Affairs does a great job in looking down the road exactly what those facilities, what their needs are. And to follow up another question regarding Veterans Affairs, we're looking at about $13.1 million in asset preservation. And we also know that for several years now, there's been three communities that have been requesting bonding for veterans' homes to be added to our five current veterans homes that we have across the state. I know Bemidji, Montevideo, and then also Fillmore County. And we have to realize that, 65% of the construction cost is covered by the feds and 35% by the state. In order to even get on the list, we need to get those part of our bonding bill and then get that list over to the feds, and then they would put us on a priority list. I don't see the governor's having that as a priority.
Commissioner France.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, well, it certainly is a concern, and I think the concern is that we, in order to get on the list and to allocate the necessary resources to qualify for that list, we need to pick a location. I think the concern is that whether all three locations would just not be feasible to start off with. So I think the concern would be the first step is we need to, as a group, come together and decide what is that the next location that should be on the list and then allocate those resources. So I know we're the governor's more than willing to consider that, but we've got to come to some agreement on where do we start.
And, Mr. Chair, just finally, I know it would be up to the legislature to select that one or two, whatever, but I know the feds have increased the number of beds that we could increase, you know, so that we could conceivably have two sites for a veterans home. But it'd just be a matter of selecting us. What you're saying is it just be a matter of just us selecting a site, and then the governor would put that on his list?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's the process is to select a site. And then once there's been a site selected, then we've worked together to figure out. I mean, that obviously would have to be included in the bonding bill. So we've worked with this committee to do that, if that's what we can make an agreement on.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Well, commissioners, thank you for your presentation, for, you know, kind of opening up the request for us formally before the committee. And, you know, the situation, of course, is that, you know, you have the governor has a large bill. And I can't, you know, almost every project on that, I think, is a very viable project. Of course, there are things that are missing, the veterans' homes, other local projects that are very important to some areas. And that's the predicament that we are in. We will be looking at these projects carefully. There will be projects that are well-deserved that we're not going to be able to fund. But even at the governor's number, that would be true. So as a committee, we'll do the best we can to come up with the best bill that we can do, and I'm sure that the governor's proposals will be given very strong consideration, although not quite all of them.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Now our friends from the University of Minnesota.
Doesn't the president of the university usually wear a gopher tie?
Well, yeah. You've got a shovel, though. What are you going to shovel?
Yeah. I've got a bigger block in the chair.
Shovel might have a different meaning in this building. You might be shoveling some other stuff. It's still
not good. There's been a lot of shoveling done in this room.
Well, we should have had an egg shovel.
Should have asked. Which project is it?
Welcome to the committee, President Kaler. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Kaler. I have the privilege and honor to serve as president of the University of Minnesota, and I'm here today with my shovel and my colleagues to tell you we are excited to start building and get shovels like this one into the ground. But let me begin, please, with a thank you. Thank you for what you as a committee and a legislature have done for the university in the past. You have provided the funds to physically transform the University of Minnesota to enable it to be the world-class Research One university system that it is. Thank you. This year, our capital request is all about renewal of our aging facilities on the Crookston, Duluth, Morris, and Twin Cities campuses. There are no shiny new objects here. Our request is focused on renovating, restoring, and reimagining the oldest pieces of our 29 million square feet of space across our system, and it is about safety, reliability, energy efficiency, and accessibility. But really, at its core, our capital request this session is about transforming our facilities some of them built in the 19th century, into the 21st century places of teaching, learning, and research for our students and our faculty. And it's about preparing our state's workforce in up-to-date facilities. In the brief period of time we have here today, you'll be hearing from students, faculty, and my boss, the Board of Regents Chair David McMillan, about our Heeper, Pillsbury Hall, and Glenn Sheen requests. I'm also pleased to be joined by Regents Michael Hsu, Darren Rocha, and I believe Ken Powell. Allow me to say just a few words about our Greater Minnesota Academic Renewal Request. This is about renewing obsolete spaces in a total of 5 buildings on our Crookston, Duluth, and Morris campuses. These projects will support learning opportunities in STEM, humanities, and teacher education programs. This is a great way to improve academic programs without the need to renovate an entire building. You may recall from your tours the old equipment garage on our Crookston campus. That unproductive space will be converted into modern 2-story chemistry and biology labs for UMC undergraduate student research. That is truly renewal and transformation. Of course, our top priority is Heeper funding. I have this shovel here because many of the 174 projects and 109 different buildings we've identified for Heeper funding this session are ready to go. That's been our track record, and we usually have hundreds of projects underway so that we have the capacity to deliver on the $200 million Heeper request. You might be interested to know that 99% of the Heeper funds the legislature invested in the university between 2012 and 2015 have been spent. And about 70% of the 2017 Heeper funding has been spent or encumbered, with the remaining 30% obligated to complete projects that are underway. So I can assure you that within 24 months of any 2018 funding, we'd have our Heeper money spent in or on construction, and this shovel will be getting ready to come out of the ground and going back to the garage. I know members of the committee saw our needs during your tours of campuses this year. Today, very briefly, our students, faculty, and Chair McMillan will remind you of the importance of this renewal to them and to our campus communities. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to highlight for you our fiscally responsible request for renewal. And now I would like to invite Associate Professor of Dairy Products Technology, Tonya Schoenfuss, and one of our outstanding students, Max Hurst, to the table to tell you more about our Heeper request.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you, Chair Erdahl.
Please identify yourself first.
I'm Dr. Tonya Schoenfuss. I'm a professor in the Department of Food Science and Nutrition, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about just one of the buildings that would be impacted by this Heeper funding. I teach and I study dairy products, but I'm also the faculty advisor for the Joe Wortheson Food Processing Center, also known as our pilot plant. What we do in food science is we have 26 faculty and 125 graduate students and 500 undergrads that we teach in this building. We educate students and the public. We conduct research on food and nutrition, and we also collaborate with industry for their innovation needs. A key facility for this innovation is the pilot plant. It's multi-use. We use it for our classroom, for our teaching, for the food science students, and they also can get part-time employment there. Faculty use the space for their research. I use it for making cheese. We do extrusion in the facility, protein processing, flavor encapsulation. Companies also come in and pay to use the space for their innovation needs. So it's mainly Minnesota companies and startups, and they're usually developing new ingredients. The other use is companies who don't have their own processing facilities yet. So Cannon-Bells is making all their product in our plant right now until they can build their facility in Cannon Falls. We also produce ice cream and award-winning cheese, which gives the students opportunities to learn how to make these products. So how will the Heeper funds help us? Our building was constructed in 1956, so it's over 60 years old, and it's showing its age. It is outdated in terms of basic safety things, such as fire sprinklers. We don't have those. We don't have handicap-accessible restrooms. The most pressing issues from my kind of selfish perspective is that we can't install new modern analytical or processing or plant equipment, and our research quality is being negatively affected. So this is due mainly to two things. One is the lack of electrical capacity and type. We have 208 voltage, we need 480. So anytime we install new equipment, we pretty much have to also install transformers or run new lines. The second reason that we have some issues is that we don't have air conditioning. We don't have air conditioning in our pilot plants and in most of our labs. So this damages our sensitive analytical equipment that's very expensive. It negatively affects the quality of the data we get from that equipment because we can't control the temperature and humidity in those spaces. And when we're manufacturing research product, it also makes it challenging to have consistent product that we can get good data from when we can't, you know, control if it's 90 degrees versus 70 degrees in the space. It's insufferable working conditions when it's 85 degrees in a closed space. So I bought a portable air conditioner that I roll around to help my students out in the middle of summer. But the main thing that I have an issue with is the quality of the data we get when we're doing these analyses. And then finally, it creates insanitary conditions when we're trying to do dairy product research or any other food product production in the plant, because we can't control the humidity or the temperature, and we have no HEPA filtration on our air source, so it can lead to contamination. So this is just one example of the importance of the HEPA funding, and on the St. Paul campus, there are a lot of similar stories to mine across our campuses and around the state, and I urge you to support the HEPA. I thank you for your continued support of the HEPA. I'll thank you in advance, and for supporting the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mrs. Schoenfuss. And don't give them the mic yet.
Okay.
Now, do you still make regular trips to First District in Litchfield?
Yes. I've also made some teaching trips there where we do some cheese training and such. But part of the North Central Cheese Industries Association, I'm an advisor for them. And First District's a they're a volunteer, so quite often we're having our meetings there in their nice conference space that they had added on next to the plant.
And you could invite me in sometime. I'd drop by.
To First District or to our plant?
First District.
Okay.
You're there.
All right. And I'll make sure I let them know that.
Do you stop at Darwin every now and then and look at the ball of twine?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry.
We'll talk about that later.
I'm usually in a rush to get there, and I drive right by when I come down from Buffalo.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Representative Constein, did you have a comment or any?
No, I'm good.
Representative Carlson?
I was just wondering if you were going to stop off at First District and bring in any of your treats that you usually do.
Yeah. My wife told me it would take at least a week before the first request came, so you're right on there. Yeah. I'm sure that can be arranged. Now,
I did bring treats. We were afraid in the interest of time we were going to take them home with us, but since you brought it up, we're bringing them out. So this is some of our award-winning cheese from our pilot plant.
A good thing for you to do. And now, next.
Mr. Hurst.
Next. Yeah, for the record, my name is Max Hurst.
Welcome, Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the honorable members of the House Capital Investment Committee for inviting us all to testify today. My name is Max Hurst. I'm a junior studying political science with a minor in business law at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I serve as the Director of Government and Legislative Affairs for our undergraduate student government, the Minnesota Student Association. I'm actually an out-of-state student from Aurora, Illinois, home of Wayne's World for those that are familiar. I remember being asked where I was going to college by neighbors and high school faculty back in Aurora. I'd proudly announce that I'd be attending the University of Minnesota and I was going to be a Golden Gopher. And I'd often be met with two replies. First, you couldn't get into anywhere warmer. And second, they have a beautiful campus. I guess they didn't know that we're also a top-tier research institution or that we have five wonderful campuses. That being said, I would have to agree with them. We have a beautiful campus at the Twin Cities and great facilities throughout our entire University of Minnesota system. I remember visiting the university for the first time and being captivated by its beauty, as well as impressed by the spaces for students to learn, study, and discover. It was important to me, and it's important to all students, to have the opportunity to learn and research in the best facilities at our home university. So when I started classes at the U, I was a bit surprised in seeing our great facilities in disrepair, whether that be a leak in the library basement or the ceiling falling apart in the tunnels on my way to class. So for these and many other fixes, the university is requesting the legislature to fund this $200 million request for HEPR. It's no small change, so it's important for us to recognize what HEPR is and why us as students support it. HEPR is improving safety measures, fixing up fire alarms and sprinkler systems to make sure that students, faculty, and staff are safe. HEPR is replacing windows and improving HVAC systems to make classrooms and lecture halls better learning environments for students, so they focus on their course material instead of that drafty window or uncomfortable heat. HEPR is making our institutions more accessible by fixing elevators and updating restrooms so students with disabilities can use them with ease. HEPR is doing the small things like fixing leaky roofs and tuck pointing our brick buildings so we can proudly show off our institution that puts Minnesota above the rest. HEPR is an investment in our future. We like to say HEPR is cheaper because by making these improvements now, we can stave off the need for greater, more expensive repairs that come from neglecting to act. It's just a plain, smart economic move. As students, we find that this HEPR request is essential. This isn't the tenant coming to the landlord asking for a hot tub installation and a heated bathroom floor. We're letting you know that the roof is leaking, the AC is on the fritz, the windows are broken, and if we get them all fixed up, the current tenants will be happy, prospective tenants will be quicker to sign their lease, and the property will stay a proud, valuable asset to the owner. It's a win-win. We have a tendency to focus on the new. It's exciting to implement a new system or policy or build a new building or simple structure. We often forget that maintaining and repairing our existing structures is also essential. Like personal hygiene, we don't like talking about it, but everyone in the room can tell when you're not doing it. With that, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee, I implore you all to continue our state's long tradition of support for a flagship higher education institution, the University of Minnesota, and all five of our campuses. I urge you all to fully fund the HEPR request as necessary for the university and our state's futures, and so that our students get the quality education they so fervently pursue. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chair, we can take questions now or at the end, as you prefer.
We have Ms. Benning. Is she?
Yes, so we have. We're going to switch out, and to tell you about Pillsbury Hall, we have Abby Benning and Zoe Winslow.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Introduce yourselves, please, and then begin.
My name is Abby Benning, and I'm a senior English major at the University of Minnesota. From the minute I stepped into my first English class at the university, I was struck by the department's warm and welcoming atmosphere. I took a class my sophomore year, a large linguistics class, with the current chair of the department, and then took a Shakespeare class with him the next semester. I thought there was no way that he would remember me, as it had been a large class. And the first thing he did when he walked in the room was to walk up to me, shake my hand, and say, "Abby, it's good to have you back in class." And this friendly interaction really epitomizes to me the warm community that the English department at the university represents. And the only way in which we're lacking that community is through a physical space. Currently, the department is located kind of squished into the second and third floor of a building that is the head of the College of Science and Engineering at the University of Minnesota. The faculty offices are in these long, spidering hallways in the dark basement. The computer labs are inaccessible to English students because you need a login from a science and engineering password to even use them. So the use of Pillsbury Hall, the renovation of it to sit as a seat for the English department, I think is an incredibly important way to really enhance that community and to make the English department as beneficial to its students as it possibly could be. The renovated building would hold spaces for the talks and events, the readings, the conferences that the department holds that are currently now squeezed in rooms that are too small for them, where students are standing or are located across campus, places that are hard for students to find. I work as a peer advisor for the department as well, and I can testify that I put up posters all over Lind Hall advertising these events, knowing full well that most students will never see them because they are taking classes in the chemistry building, in the aerospace engineering building, because we don't have a home. But if we were to be able to move into the renovated Pillsbury Hall, these students would be able to take classes in rooms that are purposely set up for the discussion-based classes that English thrives upon. They would have access to technology so that they'd be able to learn things like website creation, video editing, digital storytelling, things that, as a peer advisor, I would love to be able to tell my advisees that the department can offer them. Their first question most of the time when they come to see me is, what can I do with a major in English? And I would love to be able to describe these facilities to them and tell them how well on their way the department can get them to their careers in publishing and advertising and law and teaching. I think there are innumerable other reasons why the English department would benefit from a home in Pillsbury Hall, but I think the main point is that the department is lively, it's robust, it's community-based and collaborative, and its students and faculty deserve a space that reflects that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benning. And did you say that they do book read? They could do book readings at Pillsbury Hall?
Yeah, they could. There would be a space for readings. Author readings. Published authors will come in and read a snippet from their book.
Mr. Chair, do you know any published authors, Mr. Chair?
No, I can't. Not offhand. next, please.
Hello, my name is Zoe Wenzel, and I'm a sophomore computer science major at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. I am here today to support the Pillsbury Project, a project whose impact will affect not just English and the liberal arts, but also the College of Science and Engineering. My journey at the U began when I was actually a senior in high school, searching for the opportunity to expand my education. Among other courses, I took an introductory computer science class and discovered that it was my passion. And it was because of that class and that professor that I'm actually currently at the U. When I asked that professor his opinion on my college choices, he told me, "You will succeed anywhere, but the University of Minnesota will give you opportunities that would be hard to access elsewhere. And opportunities are exactly what I have received. All of my classes, computer science and otherwise, have been engaging and impactful. The professors are top-notch, and the quality of the education cannot be debated. But it is the community and the support that has always stood out to me. Starting my first semester, I was a teaching assistant for the very same class that convinced me to go to the U. And following my freshman year, I was given the honor to do paid research in developing programming languages with another computer science professor and possibly have yet another research opportunity for this summer. These things have given me the opportunity to become part of the computer science community while simultaneously help guide it. This is a chance that can really only be gained at a research institution like the U. Computer science and engineering as a whole are known for being majors of the future. But at the U, they give you the very real possibility of shaping the present as well. You see, my story is not unique, but that is why I believe it is so important. Across campus, computer science and engineering students are given opportunities that will shape the very campus we thrive in, who we are, and how we will change the world. But there's a problem. As interest in my major and other science and engineering disciplines continues to expand at a rapid rate, space has become an issue. I want more students to have the opportunities that I have been given, and that is why I'm here, to support just that possibility. The Pillsbury Project would allow computer science and engineering to expand into Lynn Hall, a building conveniently located in the heart of other College of Science and Engineering buildings. It would give computer science the room it needs for classrooms and collaborative learning spaces while providing a first-ever permanent home for industrial and systems engineering. I urge you all to strongly consider the Pillsbury Project as a project for building for the future, not just for the English and liberal arts, but also for science and engineering students across the campus. With your support, we can give a very real name to possibility. Thank you.
Thank you. And where did you go to high school?
I went to Mounds Park Academy.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, to finish, I would invite the chair of the board to the table to tell you about Glenn Sheen.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question of the first student to testify?
Yes.
Did I understand that you're in the same building, but you don't have access to the computers?
That's true, yes. There's a large computer lab.
Then do you know why? Are they used to the maximum by the science department? Or
the building is officially the seat of the whole College of Science and Engineering, and so the lab is meant as a study space specifically for those students. So there's an English study space as well in Lind Hall. But it's a single room, no computers. There are two desks and a couch.
Now, I have a question for the president. Why do you have a wall like that? these are computers that are purchased in part by the state of Minnesota, and I would think that there should be, if there's space and time available, access by all the students.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, the computer laboratories in science and engineering very often are equipped with highly specialized software that's licensed and restricted to the use on that particular computer. So as students in science and engineering classes need to use that software, they are restricted to using it on that computer. So those classrooms are reserved for those students doing those kinds of projects. I'm not familiar with this particular laboratory, so I don't know what the possibilities would be for opening that for more general use in limited time periods, and we will look at that. But the use of dedicated computer classrooms is not unusual in technology fields.
Mr. Chairman, it reminds me of years ago when I was chair of the Education Finance Division of Appropriations, we had an issue in the athletic department where the men's department would not allow the women's department to use things like cameras and so on. And I had a rather interesting conversation, let me put it this way, with Paul Giel. You may remember that name, and he was the athletic director. And he said, I'll take care of it. And there had been newspaper stories and so on about their attitude initially was, well, that those cameras and so on had been purchased by the men's athletic department, and therefore they wouldn't share. That's why I perked up on this particular question as to the lack of access, and I wish you would get back to at least me on that, because I would prefer a more free-flowing situation where students would have open access. If there are, as you seem to indicate, some legitimate reasons, that may be one question, but if it's just simply a situation where they don't want to share, that's a different question. So I would be interested in your response at a later time.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Do you have a response, President Taylor?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative. I will get back to you, Representative Carlson, about that. It's a very legitimate concern.
Thank you.
Thank you. Regent McMillan, we have... No, we've been to Glen Sheen, and so we're running out of time. If you could move right along on this one, please.
Thank you, Chair Dahl and members of the committee. I will be quick and brief. My name is Dave McMillan. I have the privilege of chairing the university's Board of Regents. It's a pleasure to be here today, and my opportunity is to bring this presentation to a close. But before I do that, at a high level, I also have the unique honor as the Duluthian of talking about our final, a small but important piece of our capital request, renewing the Glen Sheen Mansion in Duluth. Glen Sheen has a long and storied history, a connection to Minnesota through the mining, the Iron Range mining, the North Shore Historic Drive, a source of history for tens of thousands of Minnesota visitors who go through it every year, 95% of whom are from outside Duluth. In fact, a little over 141,000 people set foot in Glen Sheen last year, and those people made it the most visited house museum in the Midwest with an economic impact for the Duluth region that's second only to Spirit Mountain. We have in large part Director Dan Hartman to thank for that, who's done a stellar job of bringing that attraction up to those kind of numbers. It's a jewel of the Duluth community, a work and learning space for UMD students, and a draw for many around the state, and it supports all three elements of our mission, most especially and most obviously our outreach mission. Today, however, Glen Sheen shows its wear, deteriorating walls, garden terraces, aging internal infrastructure put pressure on its ability to continue doing what it's doing, and that forms the basis of our $4 million request from the state to shore up key structures, including replacing the boiler, improving accessibility, and true foundational work in the garden and in other spaces. Uniquely, with this state support, we'll pursue a $4 million match from non-state, non-university resources to complete the key infrastructure repairs. And I can tell you the board debated this at some length and landed on what I think is a unique and creative public-private matching approach to this, and that's what you have before you today. The repairs that would enable Glen Sheen to continue serving as a beautiful living history along the shores of Lake Superior and a home that we can all be proud to call our own. So to close, as President Kaler stated at the beginning of our presentation, our capital request is all about renewal of aging facilities. I spent most of last year here at the Capitol, and I heard that loud and clear. Please look for ways to repair and improve upon what you have. There are no shiny new objects in this request. We're focused on addressing the oldest pieces of our 29 million square feet of space, and in doing so, providing our students, our faculty, and all Minnesotans a world-class university and 21st century facilities. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Regent McMillan and Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have perhaps asked MMB this, but maybe one of you might have the answer. The governor has one request on his U of M. It's the clinical research facility, pre-designed the design that is not on yours.
President Kaler.
Chair Dahl, Representative Hausman, there are actually two additions. The governor did request an additional $50 million for our HEPR request to bring it to 250, and there is a $10 million request for planning money for the design of the health sciences research building. You may recall a few years ago the governor commissioned a blue ribbon commission on the medical school, and a finding of that commission was the need for two new buildings, one for education, one for research. We broke ground on the education building. That was in last year's bonding bill, and again, we thank you for that. This is planning money for the second of those two buildings. And it, you're correct, it is not on our original list.
Okay, thank you, and thank you again, Regent McMillan, for I know helping to broker that Glenn Sheen situation. I was pleased to play a little small part in helping to do that. So I know that there may be some other questions, but we really do need to move on now to Minnesota State. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And the cheese was very good, by the way. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. I might take the shovel. You don't have a Minnesota State shovel you want to put up there.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. We'll work on that.
Right. We forgot about the cheese, too. Well... All right, please introduce yourselves and begin.
Yes. Chair Ardal, members of the committee, I'm Devinder Malhotra, Interim Chancellor for Minnesota State. I'm joined today here by Associate Vice Chancellor Brian Yulitz. Thank you for your time today and for traveling to many of our 54 campuses all over the state and seeing firsthand the capital needs of our colleges and universities. Chair Ardal, as you and your committee visited Minnesota West, you all demonstrated your prowess on climbing poles. I have, on good authority from David Shute, the Powerline faculty member from Minnesota West, that he's actively looking to recruit some of you for the fall semester. Your commitment is sincerely appreciated, and we are honored to have the opportunity to tell the story on behalf of Minnesota State's 375,000 students and 16,000 employees. We're also grateful to Governor Dayton for his strong support of public higher education, asset preservation, and Minnesota State in his recommended 2018 capital program. Having served at two of our campuses, I have experienced firsthand what you already know, and that is, your investment can literally change lives of students and transform the communities where our colleges and universities are located. I would like to ask you to look at page 3 of the bonding book that highlights who our students are and the fact that we serve over 63,000 students of color, 48,500 students, first-generation students, 84,000 low-income students and 10,000 veterans and service members. Our students are the future of the state. We are the success and the economic engine for the state of Minnesota. Providing the talent Minnesota needs is at the core of everything we do as a system. Our physical infrastructure and our proposed projects are meeting the community needs, and the impact is felt by each and every student who has the opportunity to learn within these walls and who will create and drive Minnesota's future. The requested program reflects our board's capital investment priorities for the 2018 session. The program is the result of a rigorous process which starts with an ongoing comprehensive facilities planning that occurs at each of our campuses. In preparation for this legislative session, our board established guidelines outlining their focus and expectations. Specifically, they sought a capital program with an academic focus, one that demonstrates good stewardship and takes care of the space we have and need while minimizing new square footage and making spaces flexible for the future. All projects went through an intensive scoring process where the representatives from our colleges and universities reviewed and assessed all campus projects against the board's guidelines. We reviewed and prioritized nearly $280 million worth in project requests, with the board approving $94 million for the ultimate submission to you for funding this session. I thank you for your time today, and I would like to now turn over to Associate Vice Chancellor Yolitz, who will provide more details on our capital program. Thank you again.
Thank you, Chancellor Malhotra and Mr. Yolitz.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon, committee. I see everybody's got their bonding book out, and I think that's a good idea. So being respectful of your time, I think why don't we use that as a tool to walk through our capital request. I'd ask you to return to page 7, and what you'll see there, Mr. Chair and committee, is the Minnesota State request for capital bonding, a request that seeks $224 million for a capital program this session. Our top priority is asset preservation, taking care of the space we have in need. We seek $130 million to address the most pressing asset preservation needs of our colleges and universities through HEPR. In addition, there are 15 capital projects that Chancellor Malhotra described within the program to meet student success and workforce needs in 16 communities around the state. These projects renovate some 500,000 square feet of academic space, ultimately eliminating more than 75,000 square feet of obsolete space and the negative impacts that space has on our operating budgets. I think, and I appreciate the patience that you all had when you visited our campuses, of hearing at each and every stop of leaky roofs, mechanical systems that didn't work, and experiencing some of the hot and musty spaces during your tours all over the state this fall. So we can, I think you understand and appreciate the HEPR needs of our system, as well as Governor Dayton's endorsement of asset preservation. He endorsed our $130 million request, and also, as with the University of Minnesota, saw the need for asset preservation and increased that amount to 180 in his recommendation. We're very appreciative of that. I'd like to, if the committee wouldn't mind, I'd request that you turn then to page 13, and we can then take a look at some of the per capita projects and recall some of the visits that we had, as well as maybe some of the places we didn't visit, and round out our time with you this afternoon. On page 13, you'll recall our time in the damp and dusty and noisy basement of Hagsauer Hall at Bemidji State University, where you learned of our number two capital priority, our number one project behind HEPR, to replace the obsolete facility with a new academic learning center and selectively renovate other campus spaces. The initial design for this project was funded in 2014, and we're ready to roll. If we left the shovel here, we use that one. At Rochester Community and Technical College, you stood at, in the low ceiling, cramped, and stuffy spaces of the faculty offices in Plaza Hall, and that would be replaced with an addition to Endicott Hall as part of our capital priority number 3. Initial design for this project was also funded in 2014. We turn to page 14 at MSU Mankato. Many of you got to walk through the halls of our recently completed clinical sciences building that was funded in 2014 and learned about the impacts those great spaces have on the local community through nursing programs and dental programs. Their 2018 capital project renovates spaces in 4 buildings around campus that were vacated by that clinical space project. At the Coon Rapids campus of Anoka Ramsey Community College, capital priority number 5 designs the upgrade of nursing clinical spaces and classroom lab spaces to create active learning spaces for our students on the campus in the Northwest Metro. On page 16, design funding would renovate Weld Hall at Minnesota State University Moorhead that will address a significant backlog of maintenance and create flexible classrooms to meet today's teacher needs and enhance student engagement and success opportunities. If you recall the musty airs, we walked into the stage area and spent some time with the musical faculty there. It was a good visit. I think we had a good time at that campus. And then on the bottom or next to that page, we've got Inver Hills Community College, where funding would initiate the design to work to renovate the business building to create a technology and business center with more flexible, efficient classrooms for their STEM programs. Turning or looking then to page 17, recall your visit to Riverland Community College on the Albert Lee campus, where you saw how this project consolidates and improves the heavy diesel and auto service programs to serve the region. I think you also recall hearing from local industry leaders about the importance of trades and technical programs and how urgent the need was for programs like these. Priority 11 is an ongoing effort to expand the affordable baccalaureate programming within the Twin Cities metropolitan area on several of our college campuses. This project upgrades academic and student support spaces at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, Normandale Community College, and North Hennepin Community College to support multiple state university partners in delivering baccalaureate education within the walls of existing college campuses, where we can achieve a 4-year degree without ever leaving the college campus. On page 14, we begin some new projects that haven't been before the committee before. Although you did not visit Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, their small but incredibly significant Majaji project, or Start to Grow project, refurbishes classrooms in areas critical to teacher education for Native Americans and student community programs. Design funding for St. Paul College just up the street begins the process to renovate student service areas and upgrade classrooms and labs to accommodate high demand and services for the college. This project is incredibly important as it continues the momentum provided by spaces that were constructed as a part of the 2015 bonding bill to support the incredibly diverse community that is serviced by St. Paul College. Looking to page 19, Northland Community and Technical College improves lab spaces at the East Grand Forks campus, and you may recall the demand for medical training in that area. Also, their mock pharmacy that was made up of cardboard boxes and folding tables, trying to replicate the work environment that we hope to send our graduates to. Funding for Vermilion Community College replaces core classroom spaces on the campus, as well as upgrades the main building entrance. This is a small project, but an incredibly important one for a very strong campus on the Iron Range. And then finally, if you turn to page 20, design for the Student Services Project at Central Lakes College will move to make improvements the student service areas as they experience in the core portion of that building on the Brainerd campus. Putting it all together, this program touches 48 of our 54 campuses. 32 campuses would be affected directly by the $130 million in HEPR. 16 additional campuses would be benefited by HEPR projects in the 130 requested, but also by line item capital projects for those institutions. So in summary, Mr. Chair and Committee, Minnesota State seeks a $224 million capital program. With your support, our priority is asset preservation through $130 million in HEPA funding and then funding for 15 priority capital projects throughout the state. There are many elements to this program, but we're all focused on two specific things. Simply stating, student success and good stewardship. We thank you for your time and attention today, and we're happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner Chancellor Yolitz. One question that I have, you know, last year when we had our bonding proposal, you had priorities as well, and we did not do all of them. Are those that we didn't do last time still on this list?
Mr. Chair, indeed, you'll see those at Bemidji State University, Rochester and Community Technical College, and at MSU Mankato. They're the top three right behind HEPA, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm glad you did that. Thank you. Everybody, in order. Not you. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Yolitz, because he has added one thing to the book that I always ask about, and now it's right here, that if we do the Moorhead project, that deferred maintenance is reduced, $8.3 million. If we do the Riverland project, $2.8 million is removed from deferred maintenance. I mean, it's a good way for us to, yes, we do asset preservation, but if we do these, we also take a little bit off of that deferred maintenance. But I also want to thank you and say to the committee, I just think we are so fortunate with Minnesota State, because they're already doing one of the things that we're all talking about now, and that is we have to shift emphasis to 2 years. And, of course, that's been happening in that system. And always when we come to your campuses, we know that you're partnering with local employers. I mean, you know, we know that responsiveness, and I just think we are fortunate to be partners in that system.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative.
Representative Carlson.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask about what the previous chancellor used to refer to as the twins. That was Hennepin Technical College has two campuses, and the description here doesn't tell us which campus or both would be getting your description as roofs and to repair water leaks, interior damage, and mold. Are we talking Brooklyn Park, Eden Prairie, or both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that'd be both campuses.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked that question, there was a time when both campuses had virtually identical requests and only one campus made it through the system. It happened to be the Eden Prairie one. The previous chancellor said, yes, I understand they're twins, and that was corrected, but just wanted to make sure that we're on the right track and treating them both equitably. Thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, I guess I'd just like to commend you for the very, very nice booklet that you have, which is very concise, clear, easy to read, and makes our life a lot easier. You've done a wonderful job on this, and it's a good basic starting point for us to look at this, and obviously in conjunction with our site visits. So really nice job on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Soller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask a question that has more to do with the following years. Do you have somehow in your planning, particularly in the physical planning space, but I know it merges itself almost directly with the academic side, and that is to forecast out 1, 3, 5 years as to the type of things that are coming out of our business world, coming out of our, and the skill set that will be in demand in the future? Because right now, one of the things that we can have is we can be rear-looking by saying, oh, I got this many students that came in, and all we did was solve yesterday's problem. And so is there a place where that database exists, or so we could at some point maybe see an interface between this is what we're asking to do now, and this is our five-year look forward for the kinds of careers that may be coming? Because like electric vehicle maintenance might not be in your system yet, but I'll guarantee it will be in 5 years.
Chancellor Malhotra.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Great question. And yes, we do try to integrate our academic planning and our physical infrastructure and facilities planning. To just give you some examples of how we incorporate that, most of the laboratories we build now, they are built in flexible designs. And to just give you one instance, we don't put electrical fixtures on the ground or in the walls, but on the ceiling, so that the laboratory itself can be configured and reconfigured to given the projects which are needed for the students or in other ways. Similarly, other flexible designs are being undertaken both in the classroom too and also with the use of technology. And the whole idea is that we design our spaces in a manner which can be reconfigured depending upon the needs of our academic programs. And as you well know, some of the jobs for which we will be preparing our students in these facilities haven't yet been invented. And as they come along, then we want to create our designs in a manner where some of those additional needs can be easily reconfigured and dealt with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Considine. Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's just for you, for everybody.
Oh, well, is that for the entire session? we had a little conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I was under the impression that South Central's roof in Faribault was on the list also, and I don't see it here.
Vice Chancellor Yolitz.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I believe if we get $130 million in HEPA funding, we're going to take care of the roof at Faribault.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I believe the email I received said if it was at $65 million that they would be in there.
I would say 65, but I can guarantee it at 130.
Well, we'll wait and see. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. And just a couple quick announcements here. First, we have a couple of new people. Not for you guys. You're done if you want. You can stay there. I don't care. But from our last session, we have Mr. Rector, Jason, our new researcher. Introduce yourself to the crew.
Jason Rector, GOP researcher for capital investment and public safety. Last session I was a CLA for public safety, and I come here from Wisconsin.
Oh, it's mostly good. And then we have a new page, Emmett Hedin.
From Winona, just graduated college and moved up to Minneapolis and here for the session.
Where'd you go to college?
At Yale. Out east.
Oh. And here's one for you guys. You recall that the medical examiners, Hennepin County, would, you know, they have a request, and a few of us did view that facility, also known as the Hennepin County Morgue, and some of us don't need to see it again, which I have explained to you. However, that's not to say if you haven't been there, you shouldn't. And so for those who wish to go, let Jennifer know, and they'll come from, I don't want to say they're going to pick you up from the morgue. Doesn't sound right. But they will host you on a tour of the office there if you so wish. So if you want to go there, contact Jennifer, and we'll find a date and time that'll work for everyone.
And they'll bring you back. They won't leave you.
And we do also have a hearing tomorrow.
Chairman,
so,
was the morgue at least part of the building where they had the security for the Super Bowl? Remember, that was the secret where it was located, but they kind of gave it away.
That's where the Vikings went after they played. But, all right.
We are adjourned.